You see what happens when you start the show? Three drinks deep. What an appropriate end to Neon Shrines, everybody. Welcome to Neon Shrines, show of pilgrimage and power spots. My friend Mac and I have been broadcasting into the ether for the last 20 minutes with no listeners.
Tell Fatima that thank you for alerting
us. Thank you, Fatima. And really, it comes back to a joke we were saying, which is we started the show with zero listeners. Right. How right we were. We didn't know that the zero listeners were, in fact, prohibited from coming on and listening. Now, we're broadcasting out into the ether, and I guess we have one listener. So, hi, Fatima. Thank you so much for texting Mac and letting us know.
Yeah, I started texting back, but it got turned down to the microphone, and so it was texting everything that you were saying.
Oh, wow. So lucky Fatima. Anyways, people, don't worry about the first 20 minutes. It was just hilarious banter.
It'll be there in the archive, if there's an archive.
You mean the Akashic Records? Yeah. That's where we store all of the Neon Shrine show, in the Akashic Records. Which, I just have to say, tip of the fez to Madame Blavatsky. When it comes to these screwy crackpot ideas that I encounter in the wild, 7 times out of 10, Madame Blavatsky was the one introducing.
Yeah, no, she was good that way.
Yeah, and I have to say, I went back to look at Isis Unveiled. It sucks. It's horrible. Unreadable. Apparently, she was just a very charismatic person. But the writings, I mean, I think...
Well, it was better than the Secret...
Secret Doctrine?
Secret Doctrine.
Which volume?
Volume 1 or 2. Yeah. They're both fairly unreadable.
Yeah, and this is the same thing with Alan Watts. His stuff, unreadable. It lacks the zazz and vim.
Well, I tried reading him. He was sort of a hero of mine. But I read one book, which was something like The Book of You or The Book of Nothing. It was like a very simple title for a book. And it had like one point that he'd made over and over.
Yeah.
And then I would dip into other books of his.
It was same point.
It's the same thing.
Well, I'll tell you why. A lot of his books are just transcribed
talks.
Lectures. Yeah. And he'd use a dictaphone sometimes. And the book, what is it? The Taboo Against Finding Out Who You Are, or something like that. Anyways. And then they would just slap titles on him, titles that he'd never seen before.
Right.
There's only one Alan Watts book that's worth reading. It's the only one that I think he sat down and wrote.
Oh, is that the one on Christianity?
Oh, that's a really good one. No, it's In My Own Way. It's his autobiography. It's the last thing he ever wrote. And
I don't think I read that.
It's the only one of his. You know, I had an Alan Watts phase where I was obsessed, going through everything. And there's far more recorded hours of him than there are books associated. Same thing with Terrence McKenna. Anyways, the only book where I felt Alan Watts was really being introspective and really showing his hand was In My Own Way, his autobiography, where he talks about the fact that he's been an alcoholic his whole life. And it's not like, woe is me and I'm... It's like, alcohol has always helped me throughout my life. I tend to drink more than others because I'm more spiritually advanced than them. But I will say that he's like, do you want to know what's at the heart of every one of my essays and books? Monism. Monism has been the point that I've been trying to communicate for the last 40 years. Whether I've been successful or not, I don't know. And he's like, I have the gift of gab. So I'll often be talking around it without ever getting to it.
Yeah, I never quite got that message from him.
Yeah, which is funny. Neither did I. And then I read it, and then I went back and read some of his stuff. I was like, oh, I get it now.
Right.
And it's straight from Krishnamurti. You can see... And this is something that's often missed, which is Alan Watts is a theosophist. His... You know, this is the virtue of reading his autobiography. If you look at his early years, he spent them in the first Buddhist lodge under Christmas Humphreys, a theosophist.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, he was more or less raised. He was autodidact, but before that, I think he was kicked out of public school in the UK and more or less moved into the Buddhist lodge.
Huh.
And so his whole upbringing was all this theosophical stuff, which probably served him better.
Right.
And he was a sponge. He absorbed it very, very quickly. And, but you know, the monism is, deep down I wish I was one. But I just have no idea what the stakes are. Like, to him it meant so much that every philosophical problem, every metaphysical problem could be solved with ontological monism. Non-duality is the Vedanta term that he liked to use.
Right.
And I was just like, sorry, guys, I didn't go through the Vedanta stuff. I don't see why that's something I should really consider as significant
for me.
It's
kind of there in Ibn Arabi, too.
Non-dualism?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And I mean, non-dualism as a means of obviating sin? Non-dualism as a means of obviating anyone who would utter a heretical phrase or, you know, of bringing everyone in? Or,
well, it's just that the whole universe is, in effect, one being, and there's no difference between you and the real in Sufi mystical terms.
I mean, that makes sense to
Hawk.
Me. Hawk is the real.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, how would someone like Ibn Arabi approach this seeming dualism?
Probably not drinking hard cider.
No, you never know. But, you know, I've always thought about this, which is like, I guess the reason that ontological monism has to make such a strong argument is because it's not intuitive. Like, there seems to be a clear difference on the surface level. But every profound spiritual experience I've ever had made me weep for the sorrow of the world. You know, so any time I've sort of woken up for a minute, it was a waking up in unity or in concert with the animation of the universe.
Right.
And so, of course, I can never recall what that feels like after it's over.
Right.
But I can say, I come up with little slogans to remind me that I did feel it once, which is, the universe likes to play.
Mm-hmm.
Or the universe is a mirror of itself.
That's a good one.
Yeah. But, you know, any of these moments of spiritual realization, which I have to say, spiritual realization is a nightmare. Everyone who says, oh, I'm spiritual. No, you're not. Spirituality makes you unusual. It makes it hard to play well with others. Spirituality is a curse. Once you lift the veil, put it like this, a raise is not in your future. like, you know.
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different ways to experience that or think about it, but I think the less that you present yourself as spiritual or, you know, view being spiritual as something special, the better. You know, yeah. It's not that useful, and it's kind of a temptation to, like, set yourself aside as, oh, I'm more sensitive than all these other poor fools that are walking down the street.
Right. When something bad happens to me, it's because the universe wanted it to happen. When something bad happens to you, it's because you're an idiot, you know, or something.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's what one of the things you try to circumvent.
Yeah, glamour. Yeah. The occult is called glamour. Yeah. Well, let me just say, Mac, before I become too glamorous, I just want to reiterate something we mentioned when we weren't recording, which is, in fact, I will cop to the fact that my shirt's on inside out.
Yeah.
That's just something I felt like I needed to admit, you know.
Yeah, it's the funny thing is you can't really tell,
uh-huh.
except that there's a white tag on the outside of a shirt down by the waist, you know.
And, you know, because I've had it on all day like this and no one has said anything, just consider it high fashion, Mac, you know.
Well, I mean, in San Francisco, you might as well do that every day anyway.
Right, what can I say? Some of us are born with it.
At least you're not, you know, carrying a sleeping bag around your neck.
Mm-hmm. Not yet. I left that at home. But, you know, I guess this is something as I, you know, how do I put this? The reason that I've really enjoyed your company for so many years is because you are not amongst the community of people who have just discovered inner traditions. You haven't just gotten into Gurdjieff. You haven't just discovered Ibn Arabi. You've lived with these ideas for a long, long time. And I think there's something to be said for when the enthusiasm wears off, you know, when the newness of metaphysical speculation or when the newness of esotericism is no longer new and it feels like ideas that are presented and you can kind of sit with them in a way that allows you, I think, a deeper appreciation of what they're trying to get at. And I guess this is why I do my best to practice empathy and compassion with my students who are just learning about this. So I teach Introduction to Esotericism, and you should see their eyes, man. They are sparkling. They are so keen to get deep with this stuff. And in fact, I encourage them, and I really, really support them in doing it. But what I really value are the people who've been looking at it for decades and are able to sift through the stuff that's relevant to them or not. Not to tell me which one's important. Everyone has their own path. Everyone has their own sources. But why certain sources have stayed with them. That is what I consider to be more helpful for me, more helpful for my own thinking, is when, you know, that sort of enthusiasm is gone.
Right. Well, at the same time, I think you have to cultivate a kind of slow-burning enthusiasm still under the surface.
For me, that's why I use cannabis. I'll smoke like a joint or something, and then I'll pick up the Blavatsky, and I'll say, oh, you know, I see why this is interesting. I see why this has been... I see why I find it boring, because it is so saturated in today's spiritual marketplace. And so to be able to historicize ideas, I think, is key for me. You know, it's the same thing with reading Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception. I love teaching it, because all my students are like, yawn. Like, yo, tell me something I don't know. Well, here's something you might not know. When it was written in 1954, it was a bombshell. No one could believe that you could take a pill that would allow you to see God. I mean, that was preposterous. You know, it's like visiting a website that would allow you to talk to the Virgin Mary. I mean, it's just no one believed it. And because we're 70 years on, it's just not, it's so ubiquitous that it the fact that it's boring to you is itself an object of research.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, so you say.
though, you know, something that we share, at least when I hang out with you and hang out in your den, something we share is you have one of the coolest collection of books I've ever seen. But the way you deal with them is like, God damn, I got to move this stack to get to this book. And it's like a burden to you. And whenever I buy a book, I'm like, someday these will be a burden to me.
Yeah, it's true.
You know?
No, I mean, my relationship to books is kind of neurotic, but it's partly, you know, if I own this book and have it on the shelf, it's almost as good as having read it, you know? it's sort of like a magical object that, you know, if you put this in this position... this position and turn it slightly, you know, your life will get better. And so I have that relationship to books, which is not exactly healthy, I don't think. And that makes it very hard to let go of books, because every time I finally say, oh, I'm never going to read this book again. And why don't I just take it down to the used bookstore and get, you know, the $2 credit for it at least within a week. I'm like, fuck, I don't have that book anymore. I want to, you know, see that quote again, you know. So I just sort of like, okay, I'm not getting rid of any more books. But I ran out of space for books is the problem.
Well, I'm convinced that by virtue of giving it away, my mind is magnetized to it. Right. And so whatever I saw in it, now I will have that hole in my vision and I won't be able to see it again.
Precisely.
Though I remember a huge turning point in my relationship to books happened about 12 years ago when I started writing my name in the cover and penciling through it, even if it's inexpensive. And the first time I did it was a Kenneth Grant Cults of the Shadows book. It cost me like $100 or something.
Right.
The most I'd ever spent on a book, but it was hardcover. And back then you couldn't get Kenneth Grant books. And I really wanted to read that one. You know, I'd read a lot of most of the cycle of his nine books on the internet in PDF form. And that was the one I liked. And that was the one that I had so many ideas, and I was tired of writing in a notebook devoted to that. And I was like, I'm going to buy it. And I remember I had to go to New York City to buy it, and I got it from this book dealer. And I remember sitting in – the memories like sizzled into my mind. I remember sitting – I was staying with my friend in Harlem on 138th and sitting in a fried chicken joint that I really loved. And they served really cheap beer and really delicious fried chicken. And going through one chapter, two chapters, three chapters, and like the smell of the fried chicken, the kind of low murmur, the cold beer.
And what are you getting? Chicken grease on the pages of this $100 book?
No, I was wiping my hands every time I picked it up, you know, like the sort of obsessive compulsive, and underlining and writing. And I have to say, it was like this dance that I had with a thinker that is just more far out than far out, take no prisoners. If you can't keep up, that's your fault. I owe the reader nothing. You know, and when he writes himself into a corner, he uses gematria to be like, and the word klipthoth has, you know, and he adds up the letters and just continues to fly through the air.
Yeah, well, the favorite book I had for writing in was a $300 book from Brill that was like 800 pages or something, and it was by Marcia Keith Schuchart, who was like a Masonic researcher, somewhat on the verge of crankiness.
Wait, is Scholar Swedenborg?
Also.
Yeah, did she do Agent of Heaven and Earth? The Swedenborg?
Well, she did Why... William Blake's wife.
Yes, Why Mrs.
Cried.
Blake Cried, yeah.
Yeah. And I think she did the book on Swedenborg.
So the Blake book.
She's a great researcher. The only thing was that she makes a lot of leaps of assumptions. Right. And then she builds on the assumptions.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, she starts with, okay, this line or this paragraph or whatever in poetry is evocative of this idea associated with this mystical, cult. And then she builds on that.
Right.
And so it becomes a given.
Yeah.
You know, that, okay, we established that.
Yeah.
Now that, then you go further with that. And I appreciate the artistry of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, objectively speaking, the whole thing becomes kind of like a magical castle in the air.
Yeah. If I was grading the paper, I'd be like, listen, I really want to encourage you. But your first premise,
yeah,
totally fucked.
Yeah,
like Blake. Yes, it's true. Was in the same room as this guy once, but you're assuming that he initiated him into this sex magic Rosicrucian thing, and then the whole book is based on presumed initiations of William Blake.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they changed the title.
Good book though.
Yeah, they changed the title when they released it in America.
Right.
Why Mrs. Blake Cried is a beautiful title, and that's the UK publication. When it came to the United States. The U.S., I think they called it William Blake's Sexual Philosophy or something.
Some, yeah.
And it's like so bland, and I get it, you're trying to be a little more provocative for the American audience, but it just loses all artistry in it.
Yeah, well, anyway.
So, you know, we had a Swedenborgian scholar on the air here, and I was talking to him about these books, and he was just like, most fun I can have while reading. Will I cite it? Not a million years. But it's just, he was saying, if you grant that first premise, the rest is new. The rest is fantastic, in his words, alternative history.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, that's one way of looking at
it. Yeah. Well, I have a certain respect for alternative history, even though I think way too many people read it and then they take that as fact.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Particularly in esotericism. I'm thinking of, there's a book called Secret Agent Crowley, I think,
mm-hmm.
about how he worked for MI5. And it's the same thing. If you interpret this one historical moment a little differently, you get this like really cool story about Crowley writing pro-Nazi propaganda as a means of outing, you know, whatever. Crowley as Bond, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one which... Aleister Crowley turns on Aldous Huxley to mescaline in the 30s. Have you heard this one?
I think I've heard of it. I haven't read it, though.
And so I talked to the famed scholar of Aleister Crowley, Marco Pasi, and I was like, have you heard this? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, it's horseshit, right? And he was like, probably. But his attitude, which is being like, he was kind of subtly chastising me for wanting to sneer at something that no one can ever know. And he was like, I felt that to be such a learning moment when he was like, it's easy to laugh at, you know, scholars that, are self-publishing or they don't have the same bona fides. But he's like,
don't rule it out.
Don't rule it out. Exactly. That was his point. And it's and to me, that's a more interesting world to live in.
Yeah.
Which is the don't rule it out world.
Right.
No, you know, who
I,
are you?
I try to inhabit that. Most of the time.
I have to say, we share a friend that lives in the ruled out world. So I feel like I'm drafted into the service of reality to be like, I'm not the reality police. I'm just saying, maybe you shouldn't be convinced. I mean, I don't know, Mac, maybe we're the don't rule it out police, but it's like when we find a fugitive from reality, it's like, all right, maybe you should rule consensus reality in a little bit.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, well.
Well, I have some friends that will believe it because it's not true, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that's a high portion of the population. or they want it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest temptation is, I really want this to be true, so it better be true because I'm going to, you know, spend my life
fighting for
assuming
it,
yeah. Is true. Whatever.
Well, you know, I have to say, my best scholarly work always takes place in the space between what I want to be true and knowing I want it to be true. So it's the
well, as long as you know you're wanting it to be true.
Yeah, and it's like the desire to want it to be true is telling. Because it talks about a social force. And I have to say, more particularly with anarchism, the fact that I was so interested in it, fine. If I was just another...
You poor child.
Another card-carrying black shirt. You know, fine, that's whatever. But everything changed when I started to look at why I was drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of like, I finally found the key to the attic. And I could start walking around in my own psychology. I could start observing my own thoughts, and you know, after I sort of bootstrapped that process, that's when I got into esotericism, which is like, you know, for example, if you look at Gurdjieff's work, the whole thing's about self-observation. You know, why do you do that sort of thing? And I think Buddhism kind of, you know, really skims this area too. I just have to say, I love it when I'm in a class and the student asks me about Buddhism. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I just don't know much about that. Like, everyone's...
Good answer under the circumstances.
If you live in California, everyone's assumed to know something about Buddhism or be a Buddhist, God forbid. And I... Because, you know...
I tried to learn as little about Buddhism as possible. I think that's the most Buddhist thing I could do.
And no doubt you know more about it than most, which is...
Maybe so. I don't know.
But, you know, I spent, you know... I had to do religious studies as an undergrad, and the options were New Testament or Buddhism. Like, in the university world, you don't get a lot of scholars of... You didn't have a lot of scholars of Islam before 9/11. You didn't have a lot of scholars of Hinduisms before... Well, you still don't. Before the rise of the Hindu right. You know, what dominated religious studies departments? New Testament scholarship, Hebrew Bible scholarship, and some Buddhists.
Uh-huh.
And so that was always available, and I was like, all right, well, you know... At least I'll be a rebel amongst Buddhists and only read beatnik Buddhists. Only right, read right. Gary Snyder, Alan Watts, and Allen Ginsberg, Diana De Prima, and of course my favorite Buddhist is Jack Kerouac, the Catholic Buddhist. You know,
right, right.
I thought his Mexico City Blues were, yeah, they you know, was the virtue of reading the beats is some of their stuff is so bad. I felt I could write poetry too. Like, you read some of that shit and it's like...
Yeah, it's empowering.
It's empowering. You read it and you think, oh my God, this chapter of On the Road is so lousy and self-pitying and sexist and racist. Whoa, I could just give it a rip and probably do better than him, you know?
Yeah.
Turns out I couldn't. Turns out after long study, he did have prose mastery.
Yeah, this is good aspects. But I could never finish a book by him.
Really?
Even on the road. I got most of the way through it, but not all the way.
I read it every year, believe it or not.
Really?
Well, I have to. I teach it.
You have a reason. I mean, not only that, but it's sort of like neon shrines. You know?
Yeah.
It's being on a journey, being on a pilgrimage.
Yeah, and I have to say that the whole pilgrimage frame, you know, in terms of how I see my own life, and I do see myself as, you know, a pilgrim on this earth, and the earth just being one destination amongst many that you can go to in this life, you know, whether we're talking dreams, daydreams, or... I remember the first time I sat down with our friend Eric, and I started talking to him about what it's like when I meditate. And I was describing, like, all of these places I visit and these things I come into contact with and these really highly erotic scenes. Blah, 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 blah. And I remember him turning to me, which is, like, the most disconcerting thing. He's like, Jojo, I think you might be manic.
Oh, now you're noticing?
And it's like, nah, I mean, I'm just like, doesn't everyone see like bright colors and fully formed shapes and scenes and landscapes? And he's like, I can't speak for most people, but I don't.
Right.
But this is why I found meditation so easy. It's because it's like you shut your eyes and you try to get below the yammer.
Right.
You try to get below the self-talk. There's so much there to be with that I never found it boring, you know?
Right. Well, I guess it depends if that palling around with the imaginal, which is sort of what your sounds like you're doing, if that constitutes meditation or not. I mean, some would say, well, that's what you have to work your way through is not pay attention to all these colorful, bright colored beings that you run into because, you know, they're competing with the foundation of your own soul, which is more what you want to commune with or something, but that just rapidly gets into garbage. So I'll quit talking.
But Mac, I'm so lonely that if I see a beautiful Catwoman approach me on the imaginal, right, I'm all ears. And it's like, and not to be strange, but it happens. Like, there are things that are communicating, and it's like, that's a lot to take in, but it's like, nice, can you take me to your homeworld? And then you get this, you know, you get this jungle vision, and then you get the snakes, and then you get the dirt, and you get, and it's like...
Well, you've got a lively inner life there. I always, you know, find these beguiling women's faces that come up, and it's like, come on, give me a break, you know?
Oh, no!
Yeah, no, it's like, I mean, one time I made him go away by just sort of like beaming love at him and was sort of like, okay, are you happy now?
Yes.
You know, let me just try to clean my mind of any images just be.
So I've never tried beaming love. It's a good idea. But you know what really happens to me when I'm laying in bed and I can't go to sleep? And there's a place I can walk to in my mind, which is a hammock in a palapa, in a sort of grass hut, and it's raining outside. And I picture this very clearly, and I picture myself taking off my shoes, taking off my pants in my boxers and no shirt, and getting into the hammock. And if you've ever gotten to a hammock, it's not easy. You got to kind of shimmy so that you're not lopsided. And the hammock has to be kind of perfect.
Yeah.
And I get it, and I get in the sleeping bag. And you know, as part of doing this, there are these extremely beautiful ethereal beings that are highly erotic.
Right.
Sort of...
Succubi.
Yeah, coaxing me to sleep. And I'm like, oh, thanks, guys.
Oh, coaxing you to sleep?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh,
okay, no, not always to sleep. Sometimes there's a hiatus between me going in the and then going to sleep. And I'm always so grateful to them because I fall asleep immediately. And I guess if I want to be a little irreverent about it, it's I'll take whatever friends I can get. Like, now's not the time for me to be making enemies on the astral plane.
Well, yeah. You know, I read this book by a magician, which was like about his life of making love to succubi.
Oh, you got to give me the reference, man.
I'll give you the book.
Right, you're not going to need that one.
Well, I'll know where to get it. I do.
Right.
But no, I wrote a book review of it for Freudian Times. And, I mean, it was just sort of like, you know, these beings, I mean, it's like djinns. You don't really know that they have your best interests in mind. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're just like sucking energy from you. And, you know, be careful. But he's like, yes, do it. You know, here's how you can contact these great succubi and enjoy sex with them on the, you know, in the inner planes. You know, and it's just like, of course it's published by, you know, inner, what is it?
Inner Traditions.
Inner Traditions, yeah. You know. And
I have to say, we were talking about the back pages of comic book ads. This is right next to the X-ray specs.
Right.
Not having enough sex, you know. Get laid on the astral plane.
Yeah, we actually had a ad parody like that in Gnosis.
What was it? Get laid, ethereal beings. No, it was, local, you know, hotties.
Find your ideal lover on the astral plane. But it was based on the ex-wife of our mutual friend.
Oh boy!
You know, who ended up getting pregnant on the astral plane with a famous rock star's love child. I don't know whether she delivered him astrally, delivered the child.
Right.
But it was at that point that he began easing himself out of the marriage.
Really?
Yeah. It was sort of like, you have to choose between me.
Me or the astral boyfriend. I see something to it. But I guess for me, there, you know, from a young age, I was told I had a rich imagination and, like, I had invisible friends. And, you know, all this came easily to me. And, you know, as I got into meditation, I took to it like a fish in water. Like, you know, I never had to be disciplined when it came to being on the mat. I would be like, no, I'm good. Leave me alone. I'm like in the middle of something. And so now, you know, when I'm going to bed, I really have there's a community there of people and things that I'm talking to. But, you know, recently we went out for drinks, and I remember it was at Casanova. Uh-huh. And this was like an hour in, so we had both had...
You and I went out, not you and your invisible friend.
No, well, I don't know, Mac, you might be one of them. But we were out at Casanova, and it's a few hours in, so we'd had a few drinks. And it was right before you had to go, and I was like, oh, hey, before I got to go, there's just something kind of tickling in my brain. And I was like, I don't usually talk about my dreams, but I don't know, I just want to tell this to you, Mac, and then we'll go home. And you're like, all right, so we'll get one more drink. And I was like, hey, so last night I had a dream that I was talking to, like, a Jesus guy, and he was like, hey, and he was, like, doing all this great stuff, and we were having a nice time together, and he was like, hey, you know, it's really painful when you say Jesus Christ, when something wrong is happening. And he's like, it's not a big deal, it's just, you know, I'm here, and I feel that. And I was like, well, first off, I have never thought about you. I'm not Christian, I don't think about, you know, I don't think about Jesus often. But I do say Jesus Christ, and all that stuff. And he was just like, yeah, well, you know, everything has cause and effect. Like, if we live in a monad, you know, if we live in cosmic non-duality, then, you know, it's all there. It's all happening. Everything that you do has an equal and opposite reaction. And I was like, yeah, I never thought about it like that. And so anyways, I told you this, and I was like, yeah, I don't know what to make of it, but now I feel kind of uneasy about saying that. And I don't know if you remember your response to me.
I do.
All right, so yeah, I mean, what did you say?
I would take it seriously.
Right, that's exactly what you said. It's like, it's not brain science here. You were like, you got a message, listen to it.
Pay attention to it.
Yeah, so now I don't do that. I try not to.
Yeah, no, you know, I think it's better to get beyond, you know, sort of low-level blasphemy, you know.
Which had, you know, for me, it had its purpose when I was in seminary. You know, they let me in, which was their first mistake.
Right.
And this was Boston University School of Theology Seminary, which it's a Methodist seminary.
I went to a Methodist church for a number of years.
And I remember the big faux pas was I lived in the seminary house, which was this beautiful mansion right on Commonwealth Ave. And Boston University owned it, and it was a big deal. And because it was a Methodist seminary, one third of the students were Korean. And this is how the seminary really paid the bills, is they didn't give any financial services to the Korean students. So everyone got, I didn't pay any tuition. In fact, I worked at the library, so I got a little money. All the Korean students paid full price. Uh-huh. But we all lived in the mansion together, and it was me and a few other people, and, you know.
Were these both men and women?
Men and women, and about 17 Koreans. And, you know, I was there, and this is back when I was really drinking and doing drugs a lot. Not like you see me now. Not the mature guy you see now. And, you know, I was rocking and rolling.
It's all relative.
I was rocking and rolling back then. And I remember the first time I introduced my friend Bumshick, who was kind of like the boss of the, you know, the Korean students, kind of like the head honcho guy, to smoking dope, to smoking cannabis. He loved it. He took to it immediately. And then I started smoking cannabis with like the rest of the Korean guys. And then, of course, the Korean women were beautiful, but very pious. And I started, you know, hey, why don't we have a little drink? And I remember Bumshick took me aside one day and he's like, me and you are very close friends, brothers in Christ. I'm like, I'm not Christian, but I get it, you know? And he's like, do not sleep with the Korean women. He was like, if you want to alienate. And I was like, okay, I will. Like, hands off, I promise. And I was, and I abided by that. But I started introducing them to some ideas and this and that and the other. And I remember my advisor brought me in and gave me a stern talking to about how some of these Koreans are asking very unusual questions. And eventually my advisor refused to be my advisor because she claimed that I was, in her report, a pot-smoking atheist. And I had to go to the dean and answer to this. And my response to the pot-smoking atheist claim was, ah, you're half right. You know? Atheism was not on the table, but
right.
Pot smoking certainly was.
Huh.
What well, do you say?
I thought that the denomination that the Koreans were most into was Presbyterianism.
Presbyterian was, I think their president was Presbyterian.
Uh-huh.
But Methodist has a foothold there as well. And Boston University advertises itself to that. Because they have, like, Korean professors. There's a real community at BU for that.
Right.
And I have to say, there's such a excellent drinking culture amongst Korean seminarians.
Now, that you introduced...
No, no, they came over with binge drinking. And I was like, hey, I know a Korean bar we can go to. And the virtue of this bar, it's called Myeongdong 2. Presumably...
Myeongdong?
Myeongdong. And it's in Alston. And... I remember, to its virtue, you know, I used to kind of troll the neighborhoods looking for new places to go. And if there's a line, I won't go in. If there's a nice place I can get a drink, I'll be there and make friends. And Myeongdong, to its credit, refused me entrance because I was a white guy. They say, oh, where's your party? And I said, oh, no, I just want to drink at the bar. They said, oh, sorry, we're full. Only parties. And I was like, that's weird. And so I tried it again. They said, no, we're full. Only party. And I was like, so I came with my Korean friends and like, okay. And then I was like, what? Good for you guys. It's Boston, you know. You got to have some boundaries,
right?
And you know that became our place to go.
So, what was the name of your Korean compatriot?
Bumshick. But I mean, the thing is, I had to learn how to pronounce Korean names because a lot of them would say, "Oh, my name's Freddie," or "My name is James."
Right.
And, you know, after 5 or 6 shojus, I'd be like, there's no way your parents named you Freddy. And he's like, oh, no, my real name is, you know, Fred Ding or something like that. And I'd be like, oh, I see, you're just kind of...
Americanized it.
Americanizing a name. And they're like, yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, fair enough. And then I was like, what's more comfortable if... What should I call you? And I'm like, you know, everyone calls me Freddy, so just, you know, Freddy it is.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
That's cool.
Well, you know, we're coming on the hour here.
I know. Well, technically, we blew that first 20 minutes, yeah. You know, to right. Just fun and games.
But I think we should try some music that I suggest.
Okay. All right. What do you think about a little Heart Full of Soul by the Yardbirds?
I think that's good. Deep in dark despair, if you want thought only, where is she? Tell me where. And if she says to you she don't love me, just give her my message, tell her of my plea. And I know, well, if she had me back again, well, I would never. I'm not a heartful soul. I
You're my world, you're every breath I take. You're my world, you're every move I make. Other eyes see the stars up in the skies, but for me they shine within your trees reach for the sun above. So my arms reach out to you for love. With your hand resting in mine, I feel a with your hand resting in mine, I feel a power so divine. You're my world, you are my night and day. You're my world, your every prayer I pray. If I love,
of you. I trust you in my home, you wouldn't leave my wife alone. Be glad when you're dead, you rascal you. You ask my wife to wash your clothes, you rascal you. You ask my wife to wash that dirty shirt, you rascal you. You ask my wife to wash your clothes, something else I suppose. Be glad when you're dead, you rascal you. Wrong, you rascal, you.
No, I didn't.
You know you done me wrong, you rascal, you.
You're wrong again, I tell you.
You know you done me wrong. You done stole my wife and gone to St. Louis.
What?
Be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
You tell you wrong.
You asked my wife for a meal, you rascal, you.
Well, that's all I wanted was a meal.
Ask my wife for a meal, you rascal, you.
What more was it for me to ask for?
You asked my wife for a meal, and something else you tried to steal.
No, no.
Be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Wrong again.
There ain't no use to run, you rascal, you.
And where you think I'm gonna run to?
There ain't no use to run, you rascal, you.
Ain't gonna run nowhere.
There ain't no use to run.
Why?
Cause I'll pip a pistol at you.
Well, oh, mercy.
Be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
I got the soul, I've got the spirit.
like it. I like it like that. I like it. I like it. I like it like that. Hey, special shout out to Stella, who has just tuned in, bumping our numbers to an astounding 3.
Oh, I thought it was we were up to 8 or 10.
Sadly, that number is fixed. It does not move. And so it is not an accurate representation about how many people are listening. But a special kiss kiss from both of us to Stella, a very special listener, and a very kiss kiss to Fatima.
And also Dixie.
And kisses all around to all of our beautiful lady listeners. It's clear that we have an audience.
Yes. For better or worse.
For better or worse. Apologies in advance. But, you know, there's actually two things I thought of. In that commercial break, I sprinted over to the liquor store to re-up our supplies. So now we're ready to tackle the second hour. But I should say, Mac, there's one point that we made when we thought we were recording and, in fact, talking to the astral plane, which is everything is forever. Everything is always final. Everything is the last time until you do it again. Nothing is promised. And there's just one thing I want to get on the record, which is, oh yeah, the anecdote that the first time I took acid, I looked at my friend and I said, oh my God, what if it changes me forever? What if I'm a different person? What? And he looks at me dead in the eyes and says, that's the point. And I just want to say, that's words to live by right there. The change is forever, and it's always you can't save anything. It's the first noble truth of Buddhism. Life is suffering. It's all going to decay. It all falls apart. You can stack up as many rare first volumes as you like. They will rip. They will dissolve.
Yep.
You can't project your desire for immortality on objects. They will break. Your friends will die. Your family will go. You know what I'm saying? It's all happening. And it's just, that's fucking hard to deal with on the everyday level, you know?
Yeah.
But I will say this. You know what helps me? As I said, Stella's no longer here. So I find myself having all of these like interactions throughout the day. One third of them are negative. Like one third of them are me Vespaing around town and some car cutting me off and being like, fuck you. Like, one third of my interactions every day are hostile.
Huh. You have a lot of interactions, I guess.
I do. I'm just, you know, I'm kind of present in a way that most people shouldn't be. And what I've noticed is, you know, because, you know, earlier we were talking about this sense, you know, whenever I've had a mystical experience, it's confirmed that it is a monadic universe, that whatever is happening, we're all involved in it and we're not separate, but we're all participating in the same becoming and we're all part of it. We're all happening together and no one's separate and we're all involved. But those are the mystical moments, because every other moment it's like, fuck this asshole. Yeah. who was transgressed.
No.
Whatever ethical boundaries I feel I have.
Well, I have not the special privilege of living next to a SRO hotel.
Oh, boy.
And one of the inhabitants of this hotel, who I think is out of his mind, you know, it's like, and luckily I think he moved on to another hotel to grace them with his presence. But,
oh, boy. Is this the guy that would scream, fuck, all the time?
Well, it was fuck you. Yeah. And he would do it as a mantra.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And, you know, it would go on for an hour. And, you know, our building is like a yard from that building with a narrow little alleyway between us. And he would do it with the window open facing our flat. And so, you know, I mean, that's like a spiritual discipline to be able to put up with this guy who's just generating the maximum amount of negative energy to piss off everybody in the, you know, vicinity that could hear him. And that really helped get me to go out on two walks a day, you know.
Right. Which I have to say, I'm thankful for, because your health, let me tell you, Mac, you look great.
Well, thank you.
You're getting your steps in. You're seeing the community, you know. But, you know, part of the reason that I feel as though I can move through the city and not be bogged down, it's not just the amount of negative experiences I have, but I actively practice forgiveness, which is linked to forgetfulness, which is like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to take that personally. Like, I understand that everyone's going through a hard time, and it's not easy being human. Being human sucks. And
right.
So it's like, all right, well, no problem. It's not about me. And then, like, 3 days later, I'll be like, wait a minute, 4 days ago, I had a run-in that was very ugly, and I'll be like, well, I forgave him, so it's not a big deal. And I remember not too long ago, I was out with like a few anarchists. Like, their identity is anarchist. And I can talk the talk. Like, I know my Bakunin and Kropotkin and, you know, all the rest. And, you know, we're having a great time as anarchists and having a fun time talking about the election and politics and not voting and da da da. And I remember at the end of the night, we went back to someone's house to do, you know, more fun drugs than alcohol. And I remember looking at the ringleader of moral rectitude. Like, this was a moral anarchist. And this was someone who wanted to control other people and to really make sure everyone fell in line to her view and the first to condemn, the first to, you know. And I was like, you know, the problem with anarchists of your school is they don't have a way of forgiving. There's no forgiveness once she was vegan and all this other stuff. And I was like, there's no way to come back from it. There's this like, and I was like, I'm curious as to like what forgiveness. And she starts like berating me about this and that. And I was like, uh-huh, yeah. But it's like, how do you forgive? And she was like, don't try to talk over me. And I was like, oh, right. Like, there's no forgiveness. Like, I did it to myself. You know, I saw the beehive and I poked it.
Right.
And it it's like, you know, I proved my point in the worst possible way, which is like, you know, practicing forgiveness. I don't know who does that. Like, the ones that talk the loudest about it are evangelical Christians, but they're the worst.
Mm.
Like, they're so moral. They're so quick to judge.
Right.
Like, actual forgiveness is self-defeating. Actual forgiveness is really difficult, but I consider it a really important practice for making it through my life in San Francisco, where I'm constantly in public. I'm like going to buy a loaf of bread, I have to bump into 12 different people and not taking it personally. Like, right. Not thinking other people's judgments on me or other people's projections on me are accurate. Not taking it personal. And the big problems I see when I go out, like, I like to go out at night and have a drink. The times I see bar fights is when people, are you talking to me? Like, you think you could talk to me? And it's like, my first thought is, did they go out looking for that?
Yeah.
Like, did they go out looking for someone to give them the side? Was that the goal the whole time? Because I remember this happened a few nights ago, like a week ago. There was a fight going on. I was like, oh, one person could just be like, no, it's good. Like, they were like two dogs going, wah, 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 like, and waiting for the other dog. And I just thought, man, I'm a cat. I don't want to spend my night getting my blood up.
Right.
But I realize that I'm my own person. And there are other people that do want to spend their night getting their blood up. That's what they want to do on some level.
Yeah. No, I think that's true in a lot of circles and in certain cultures. And I think there are forms of alcohol that actually trigger that. You know, I think that scotch tends to make people more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas a tequila makes people more euphoric.
That's what we drink, so, you know.
Yeah.
So. Actually, I have you to thank for that. I went over and drank your Kirkland brand tequila, and I said, you know, I could get used to this. And then you told me it was $26, and it became the house liquor.
All right. Well, Costco has some good bargains on some things.
Please wait while we give a sponsored ad to our friends at Costco. No, but you were saying that, you know, to me it seems as though people are invested in having confrontations. And I almost feel like if I gave in to that, I would be satisfying them.
Right.
And so there seems to be nothing more satisfying than just kind of ignoring them or walking away from it.
I think some people like to do that in real physical presence and do it with other people, whereas so much of our culture these days likes doing it on X, on Twitter.
Oh, right, on
you
the
know,
internet.
And it's like full of people looking for a fight and also looking to condemn others or you know, cuss them out or whatever.
I have to say, I don't have Facebook, so I get so little of this.
I'm not on any of those. You know, I generally avoid them as much as possible.
Though I have to say, I do surf Wouter Hennegraaff's Facebook, and it's a locus of people just like throwing haymakers. And because he's Dutch, he wants to reason it out with all of them. And whenever I talk to him, I'm like, get off Facebook. It's a psychotic interzone of mentally unwell people. I put it like this. I've never seen people say, hey, I got a bushel of olives from the guy down the street off Facebook. Hey, I met my wife off Facebook. No. You know, you never hear great things happening. Oh, I found someone to paint my house and they did a great job. On Facebook, you hear the opposite. You know, I got a stalker or this guy made a death threat or whatever. Anyways. Humbug. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Bah humbug.
So here it is, our last
last hurrah,
last time on this show. It seems like we ought to do some very neon shriney thing for a few minutes at least.
Wait, is there a neon shrines thing? What is that? I thought it was just an excuse to do Christmas specials for all of November.
Well, there is that aspect, yes. I don't know. I didn't.
Oh, talk about travel. Okay.
Yeah, which I, the older I get, the less I feel like traveling. If you can get me off my block, you're doing well.
Actually, I have to say, when we're just hanging out, I can get you to start talking about travels. I can get you to start talking about places you've traveled. And the stories you tell are so memorable that I learn lessons from you about, like, leaving your wallet in the cab. Like, things like that. So now I check my wallet like 10 times before I get out of a cab. Anyways.
Well, good.
I have to say, like, hearing your reflections about it are very much Order of St. George's Horse canon. Like, at this point, that's dogma, which is like, oh, you got to listen to what Max experiences and then never do that yourself.
Yeah, right. I pioneer things not to do.
You learn by example.
Right. No, I used to enjoy going abroad and you know, getting to know London or Istanbul or whatever. But ever since the pandemic and airline travel's gotten so annoying, I just don't. And, you know, you hit your 70s and sort of like, well, why should I go anywhere? I've been everywhere I went on to go, which is almost true.
Is there places you...
I still had to go to Budapest.
You want to go?
I would like to go.
Yeah. You ever been to Hungary?
No.
No. You haven't been to Hungary at all? You know, I was fortunate enough to go to Budapest 2 summers in a row. Mm. I was invited there both times. And I thought, oh, that's not on my itinerary, but let's rock and roll. And you know how Stella is. Stella, you know, travels with her passport in her back pocket. So she's, you know, she's like, okay, you know. We ended up going there twice in a row. And this is why, you know, how do I put this? You know, when I approached the career of being an academic, I didn't do so that I could get tenure. I didn't do so that I could live my life in faculty meetings. I did it because I liked it. I did it because I enjoyed the conversations. I could finally talk to people who have read books in the same way that I read books. It's like talking to you. It's other people that are like clearly preoccupied with questions that no one else gives a shit about. Like, I'd go home to talk about, you know, different interpretations of the Hebrew. You know, forget it. No, they have their own lives that are far more important, frankly, and far more realistic in terms of the outcomes. But I wanted to have certain conversations, and the only place I could find that was in the university. And I had some really great colleagues to talk to. And so I found myself doing that. And then I found, oh, my God, wait, I can travel the world? Like, people will invite me to do this? Wow, okay, I really want to do that.
Right.
And now that I'm getting into the sort of how do I put this? The grind of being a university worker, you know, being a lecturer, I realized, oh my God, it's a rigged game that I cannot win here. And any attempt I make to swim upstream is only going to visit frustration on me. And so there has to be a way, and I think I've mentioned this before, Mac, I hate competing with people who have the same credentials as me. I hate going through the front door. You know, if I'm trying to get a job and three other people have degrees in esotericism, I don't want that job. I don't think I'll get it. I don't interview well when it comes to people who do what I do better. I interview extremely well when no one has heard about what I do and I can make a case for it. That's really the sweet spot for me. And so, you know, instead of trying to make my way up through the ranks, I find that I'm much more comfortable trying to build new structures. And then frame those structures as very inviting to other people like me. Because, believe it or not, I really believe that the majority of people that go through the university are not supposed to be scholars. University is something you have to do now.
Right.
As a rite of passage.
Right.
And I'm not sure it benefits everyone. I'm positive it doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm positive that is money ill spent to go through university. So, you know, I do my best to try to show them that, hey, you know, whatever talents you do have, that's what you should focus on. You know, and as I like to joke, there's always law school.
Well, let's listen to another tune or two.
Okay, so, hey, before we do a tune, can I just say one final thing about Succubi?
Okay.
All right. So, I mentioned Kenneth Grant earlier.
Yeah.
And he was an occultist. I mean, for whatever reason, Aleister Crowley always annoyed me. That's the word, annoyed. It's not like he offended me. Like, I get it. You're a transgressive guy. Like, that's cool. And it's not like I found him dangerous. It's like, no. I mean, there's other stuff that you could read that would really get you in trouble. You know, you're not one of them. It was just, it's like, I get it. Like we were saying earlier about Aldous Huxley. His ideas are so ubiquitous that they don't scandalize me. In a way. And plus, I didn't start reading him until I was in my late 20s. And I think if you read him in your early teens, he would be very important to you. But in your 20s, it's just, you know, I get it. It's not so interesting. But Kenneth Grant did impress me in my early 30s. I mean, that was really hot stuff because it had no regard for the reader at all. No regard for the reader's sensibilities. He was so self-assured in what he was saying that it's like, oh, if you don't get it, then you're not initiated high enough in the ISIS lodge, you know. And he goes on and on and on about succubi. He goes on and on. He says every time it's biblical. He has this sort of like sex fear, which is every time you do self-pleasure, you're feeding succubi. And so you shouldn't do it. And every time you orgasm, it should be productive. And I thought, I remember picking my head up as soon as I read that, like, you should, onanism is off the table. And I remember thinking, that's what I got in this for. Ideas that nobody would ever endorse, but this guy is going to the mats for it. Like, that, like, every time you enjoy erotic material, that is feeding. So I thought, whoa. You talk about heavy-handed occultism. Like, this guy has a system and he's sticking to it, you know?
Well, you know, I read a fair amount of him. I've got 6 or 7 of his books, and I didn't read them all. But maybe his teachings on succubi did have some effect on me on a subconscious level that I don't remember. Because, you know, my feeling in the imaginal is, you know, if some appealing succubi shows up, you know, to send them on their way.
Oh, no, I'm the opposite. I invite them in for a drink, and I'm like, hey, talk to me. Talk to me, sweetheart. Like, what's your deal?
No way.
And so, and you know, there's this really famous story about the Buddha, you know, when he achieved enlightenment, you know, Siddhartha was sitting under the Bodhi tree, and like as part of the trials, Maya comes, you know, Maya illusion, delusion comes and does a seductive dance is how, you know, the sources describe it. And I don't read Sanskrit, but I assume seductive dance is an interpolation of what exactly happens. And I guess, you know, I'm much more invested in being friends with the universe. I mean, if I am a cosmic non-dualist, that means that even the succubi will be raised up. Even the succubi will be anointed and will ascend someday. And I guess I'll be ascended with them,
but I
won't do it before them. Like it's a bodhisattva thing, which is like, listen, they're the ones contacting me. They're the ones reaching out. And I understand that I could plumb deeper and maybe get to more fundamental grounds of being. But for the time, I mean, you know, they're the ones helping me get to sleep every night with this. I should also mention, in the studio, I'm standing up. I have a herniated disc that is just a son of a bitch. And they're the ones that come to me after I take my 500 milligram Tylenol. And they're like, remember this little hammock? And I'm like, yes, thank you. Take me by the hand. I'm in a lot of pain. And they're like, you'll be fine. And they want to touch me erotically. They're like, girls, not tonight. My back is killing me. Right. I'm fucked up, man.
Well, you've got a different approach. I admire it. I don't know. I just sort of feel like usually it's just I'm trying to get to sleep. That's the thing. And they're getting in the way of it.
Yeah, right, right.
You know,
they're keeping you up.
I'm just trying to get to sleep. Get out of here.
Hey, Mac, come over here. Do, 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 do. Fuck off.
Yeah, you know.
But are you getting like 10 hours of sleep? I mean, you lay down and you sleep through the whole night. I can't. I wake up at like 4 a.m.
No,
I have leg pain.
Yeah,
and I'm like, oh, I got two sleeps a night. I want my 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. What is that? 10 to 11 to 12 to 1. I want my first 3 hours to be good, and I get up and I come my back, and then I go back, and then I wait, and then I go to sleep at like 2, and I wake up at like 6.
Well, I wake up often more than that. You know, sometimes it's like every 2 hours or something.
Oh man!
But it's like if I don't get in good dream time, then I wake up tired. Even you know, if I was in bed for 9 hours or something. So, and often the best dreams in that way, meaning they kind of relieve parts of my psyche that wanted to express themselves or whatever, you know, are like between 5 and 6 in the morning or something like that.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's all in the interest of, come on, I want to sleep.
Leave me alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, time for tunes.
So I got a very special track for you that I selected it out for you and your tales of travel, and it's by They Might Be Giants. It's called Istanbul, Not Constantinople. Maybe you know it.
Right.
Liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Istanbul, even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
You just liked it better that way.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone, a Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
the Turks, Istanbul.
This is an instrumental, isn't it? Okay.
Can Mary fry some fish, Mama? I'm as hungry as can be. Oh, Lordy, how I wish, Mama, that you could keep the baby quiet, 'cause my head is killing me. I saw my ex again last night, Mama. She was at the dance at Miller's store. She was with that Jackie White, Mama. I killed them both, and they're buried under Jenkins' sycamore. You think I'm psycho, don't you, Mama? Mama, pour me a cup. You think I'm psycho, don't you, Mama? You'd better let 'em lock me up. Don't hand me Johnny's pup, Mama, 'cause I might squeeze him too tight. I'm having crazy dreams again, Mama, so let me tell you about last night. Up in Johnny's room, Mama, standing right there by his bed, with my hands around his throat, Mama, wishing both of us were dead. You think I'm psycho, don't you, Mama? I just killed Johnny's pup. You think I'm psycho, don't you, Mama? You'd better let him lock me up. You know that little girl next door, Mama? I believe her name was Betty Clark. Oh, don't tell me that she's dead, Mama, 'cause I just saw her in the park. Sitting on a bench, Mama, thinking up a game to play. Seems I was holding a wrench, Mama, and then my mind just walked away. You think I'm psycho, don't you, Mama? I didn't mean to break your cup. You think I'm psycho, don't you, Mama? Oh, Mama, why don't you get up?
That's right, everybody. Having fun in the studio is what we are all about here on Neon Shrines. We're approaching the last 15 minutes or so of the show. And, you know, as the end grows near, I just want to take a moment to thank all 8 of our listeners. You know, everyone who's tuned in for the last, I think this is show 81. You know, that's like 160 hours. And I just want to say, hey, listen. Well, I was going to say we do it for you. We don't. I do it for my own amusement. The reason I'm on the air is because it's funny, and I find myself having conversations I wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah, indeed.
And, you know, off air, Mac and I were talking that in some ways, Neon Shrines is a show for us to talk about pilgrimage, but it's also an excuse for us to do 2 months of Christmas broadcasting. And I don't know why Christmas occupies such a large space in my mind, but here we are, and it does. But let me just tell you, I've had a lot of fun talking to y'all, and I have to say, I feel as though Neon Shrines is something, it's a piece of media that will be buried. I don't plan on promoting it. In fact, I plan on taking it from the public eye and burying it. And so it will not be available. And then, you know, in 30 years from now, who knows? I think it would be an artifact worth digging up. But it's like one of those time capsules. You know, I don't need to do this for money. I don't do it for money. And I feel, in fact, if anyone heard this, it would hurt my prospects about getting hired. So I think it's a perfect time capsule experiment in media, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a exercise and a challenge for me since I'm sort of the introverted type. So when our host asks me direct questions where you need a snappy answer, you know, instantly, it's sort of like I can hear the clock ticking while my mind is going, oh, man, what do I say now?
Torture.
You know, it's sort of like my mind goes blank. So.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I keep my mind blank permanently. I strive for mind blankness.
Well, my mind is always busy dealing with 5 minutes down the road or something.
Uh-huh. Well, everybody, 5 minutes down the road from now, you're going to be hearing the voices of Basement Radio. That's right. Our friends Luca and Mitsu are going to come in and regale you with stories of their recent screening of Harmony Korine's Gung-Ho. One of my least favorite movies. I have to say, I absolutely hate that movie. So I did not attend the screening, but...
But you should look forward to the show.
You should look forward to the show because they're always hilarious. But I will say, not to let the cat out of the bag, but, you know, I mentioned to them that Neon Shrines was drawing to an end. And in a lot of ways, Mac, I kind of want to bounce this off you, which is I am not hesitant to draw things to a close when they're over. When something is done, it's done. And I know when the energy's there, it's obvious to me. I jump out of bed and I want to do it, and I do it. And when it's over, I want to do more of it. And when that starts to go, it's a clear message that I have to go. And that's not just something I do with creative projects, but it's something in my personal relationships. It's something in my professional relationships. Like, I'm willing to burn a bridge if I'm never going to cross it again. And I have to say, that has treated me so well throughout my life. That impulse to just act out in a way has always been for the best, for me personally.
Well, I think it's always best not to burn a bridge because you never know when you might want to go back in that direction. So I would differ with you in that approach.
But I guess, you know, I've had negative reinforcement, which is I remember very distinctly. I was at this. I was back in seminary, and I knew that I was going to be more or less bounced. And I went to this dinner, and there was this talk by this theologian talking about ecumenicism, and I made a mess of it. I was half in the bag. I stood up and I interrupted the talk, and I was like, I can't believe we're doing this. This is a farce, a sham, all of it, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And I didn't know I was going to do that night, but I had this impulse and I knew it was right. And it was like ringing a bell. I knew it was what I had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, you wouldn't believe the people who came out of the woodwork to say, hey, you're kind of a mess, and I won't say this publicly, but hey, man, that's where I was at. And some of those people, I ended up going to another seminary. They stayed in touch with me, and there was that sense of, like, waking up from a long sleep. Hmm. That, oh, wow, because I feel like so much of my life is sleepwalking, there is that moment of just, like, crisis. That, you know, here's someone who's having a total breakdown. And, you know, Mac, we've been friends long enough. You know, I think you've sailed the breakdown seas with me a few times.
Uh-huh. Right.
And I have to say, you're one of those friends that I always, you know, long to hang out with when I'm having these troubling moments. I don't know whether it's because you're even keeled or you've been there, done that, or what it is, but, you know, your outlook seems to lend itself to tranquility or to, like, yeah, this too will pass or something.
Yeah, well, it will pass. Yeah, well,
I guess that's
I'm happy to render that service.
And so what? You're going to do a show on Radio Valencia once Neon Shrines bows out? You'll have the Mac
No,
out?
I think not. But I will say that when I was a kid, like junior high, I did sort of daydream of being a disc jockey. And then when I went to art school in New York, they had an internal radio that just broadcast within the dorm and a few of the art school buildings. And I did do a radio show for 2 semesters, I guess, maybe, or 2 years. That was me being a really snide punk and playing the Stooges.
Yeah!
And, you know, blues and just sort of like... Just being a real asshole on the air.
Music your mama don't like. Another one coming out from Mac. Yeah, Alan Wolf.
It was nothing like that. It was just sort of like very low key, but just doing very aggressive music.
Well, on that note, everybody, what do you say? We'll play a few tracks. How about After the Gold Rush by Neil Young?
Well, that's not... Do we have anything a little more?
Okay, how about Harry Nilsson's Everyone's Talking?
No, neither of those match.
I'll give you the list, and you point one out that's real rock and roll, asshole, snide. And we'll play that one like it's going to happen. And in the meantime, I can kill some dead air.
No, I think All Your Love by the Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton. That's got the right...
All right, what is it? It's Eric Clapton, who's an artist I can't say I've really listened to a lot.
Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton. It's the Blues Breakers is the main artist.
Mm-hmm.
That was a British blues band that he was with for a year or so.
And it's called All Your Love?
Yep. Yeah.
Hell yeah, dude. This is it? Yeah, get it.
Yep.
up, everybody? This is your main man, JoJo, joined in the studio.
By Mac.
By Mac, his main man. We're here to wish you all a beautiful lifetime. You've been listening to Neon Shrines, a show of pilgrimage and power spots. We've made it to our destination. After much trials and travails, here we are. Enjoy it. Soak it up. These things don't come more than once in a lifetime.
Indeed.
All right, everybody. Enjoy this last one. I've Got You Under My Skin by Louis Prima. This is how we want you to remember us.
Under my skin,
I tried so not to give in.
I said to myself, this affair never could go so well.
But why should I try to resist when Luigi I know so well?
Little Mugetti under my skin.
I'd sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near.
In spite of the warning voice that comes in the night and repeats in my ear.
Don't you know, little fool, you never can win.
Use your mentality. Before you begin,
'cause I've got you, ooh, under my skin.
I've got you, ooh, under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything, come with my,
for the sake of having you near.
In spite of the warning voice that comes in the night
and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win.
Use your mentality.
Wake up to reality.
For each time you do,
just the thought of you makes me
stop before you begin. 'Cause I got you under my skin.
Oh, I got you under my skin.
Yeah, I got you, baby, under my skin.
Oh, holy mackerel, under my skin.
I've got you under my skin.
And with that, we come to the end of our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Neon Shrines and encourage you to join us next week as we dive even deeper into the world of pilgrimage and power spots.